Tony, and thank you, Cheryl, for getting us started here. And Cheryl talked about some of the impact that we've seen from the western flower thrips in terms of the damage it can do and its just general devastating effect around the world. What I'd like to do is take a look at some of the underlying biological attributes that contribute to making the western flower thrips so devastating and difficult to control. And I don't know why my slides are going on their own, but as Cheryl pointed out, there's been an increase in interest in western flower thrips and research on it. I gotta keep up here, but over the last 20 years or so, about 40% of the publications on western flower thrips have dealt with, or publications on thrips have dealt with, this one particular species. And so what have we learned from all this research? Well, I've learned a good deal about the basic biology and ecology of the species, its reproductive habits, the importance of its haplo-diploid life cycle, its host range, and ability to transmit TOSPO viruses. My goodness. In terms of its pest status, if we think about what makes it a pest, we know it's invasive, it has a high reproductive potential so that populations can build up quite rapidly to exceedingly large damaging levels. It attacks, again, a wide range of crops. It's a vector of the TOSPO viruses, and importantly, we've seen greater and greater development of insecticide resistance. But if we go back and think about just the basic life cycle of the western flower thrips, it's very similar to other pterobranchian thrips. There's the egg stage, followed by two larval feeding stages, and two non-feeding quiescent pupal stages. And in western flower thrips, both males and females are known, with the females generally being much larger than the males. And one of the first areas to look at in terms of the life cycle is the oviposition. And as with other pterobranchian thrips, the females have this saw-like ovipositor that they use to insert eggs directly into the upper layer of plant tissues. And this can either be in the foliage, the flowers, or the developing fruit, as you see here on this tomato. And the active oviposition leaves behind this scar, and that, of course, is a huge aesthetic concern. So oviposition itself can cause economic damage. But a greater amount of damage comes from the act of feeding. And western flower thrips, like other thrips, has this piercing mandible that they use to penetrate plant cells and drain the fluids out of those cells. And the adults and larvae feed in the same manner on the same type of host plant resources. And they tend to feed in localized areas. So you get this repeated feeding that produces the scarred area on the plant surface. And of course, again, that's a huge aesthetic problem for ornamentals and other types of crops, as is the frass spots that they leave behind as they go around feeding. And one of the most important aspects about the general biology of the western flower thrips is that they like to remain in closely concealed, sort of cryptic areas on plants where they're not openly visible. And this cryptic behavior is also termed thigmotactic behavior, where they like to be touching some part of the plant. And so often the damage that they do as they're feeding isn't visible until much later in the plant's development. So they can feed on the flowers and the scarring isn't evident until the flowers begin to fully expand. And they are called western flower thrips for a good reason, that they do prefer to remain in the flowers. So we've done some studies looking at within plant distribution, and we see that here on peppers and tomatoes, when flowers are available, almost 100% of the adults and larvae are there in the flowers, as opposed to other plant structures. And so, but they also, if flowers aren't available, can feed on other plant structures. And when they feed on leaves, they tend to again be in the terminal leaves that are closed over and haven't fully expanded out. And the feeding damage there results in the leaves becoming distorted as they continue to develop. And so again, another aesthetic problem, as well as interfering with just the normal plant growth and development. They'll also feed on fruits like these tomatoes or peppers or nectarines, and the damage again becomes very localized to areas where the fruit are touching one another or touching a stem or overlaid by a leaf. Again, it gets back to that thigmotactic behavior, and so you get these localized areas of scarring. And so again, you know, another huge aesthetic problem for growers. And the problem with Western flower thrips is that you don't just have one or a few thrips, you have a lot of them. As you can see, all of these adults thrips here on the passion flower. And so the next question is to look at where the Western flower thrips reproduces or how it reproduces. And it has this haplodiploid sex determination that means that fertilized eggs produce females, unfertilized eggs produce males. And it's important to keep in mind that females can mate and oviposit throughout their lifetime. And these are some data looking at the reproduction of Western flower thrips and their survival from laboratory studies that we've done. And the females can live for a very long time. The 50% survival time for a cohort runs up to about 25 days under lab conditions. We've done mark recapture studies in the field, and we know that females can live for at least a week under field conditions. So they're quite long lived, and throughout that time, they're ovipositing several eggs a day following usually about a 1 to 2 day pre-oviposition period. And as Cheryl pointed out, it's a pest on a wide range of crops, and we'll hear some talks on these different commodities coming up in the symposium. But it's also a key aspect to their ecology is that they can feed and reproduce on a wide range of weedy, uncultivated host plants. And this brings up one of the key points, at least as an ecologist, to keep in mind is to distinguish between plants that the thrips can reproduce on that support actual larval survival and development versus plants that you encounter adults on that are just adult feeding hosts but don't support larval reproduction. So over the last few years with Joe Funderburk, we've done a number of surveys monitoring different plants for the presence of Western flower thrips, and found about 30 plants that we've monitored that we find adults on. So the adults can feed on a broad range of plants, but only about a third of those species turn out to be true reproductive hosts. So the reproductive host range can be large, but it's not nearly as large as the adult feeding host range. And that has some important implications for the population dynamics and virus epidemiology. So what does all this biology mean in terms of making it a pest? Well, in terms of the invasiveness, their small size, this thigmotactic behavior where they like to remain in concealed, enclosed areas on plants, means that they are difficult to detect. And so with all the shipments that Cheryl's seen passing through the ports, You have a lot that may go unnoticed. And also, the fact that they overposit into plant tissues means that there may not be any thrips evident on the plant, but the eggs are still there, and they, because they're internally on the plant, are difficult to see without the use of a microscope and often staining of the eggs. Their prolificous nature means that there are a wide range of crops that they can be exported on, and once they arrive in a new area, there's a high probability they'll find a suitable reproductive host to become established on in new environments. And the haplodiploid sex determination also means that with the females being long-lived, they can potentially survive long enough to mate with their male progeny, so very small founder populations theoretically can be quite successful in establishing. And now the next area to look at is the interaction with autospiroviruses. And Western flower thrips is known to transmit at least 5 different tospoviruses, including tomato spotted wilt, impatiens, necrotic spot, probably the 2 most important worldwide, as well as tomato chlorotic spot, groundnut ring spot, and chrysanthemum stem necrosis virus. So spotted wilt is the most important, again, on a worldwide basis, and it can infect over 1,000 different plant species. So simply based on that, it's quite important in a range of cropping systems, and the Western flower thrips is the most efficient vector around the world. And the virus and insect have a very tight, intimate relationship. If the adults are going to transmit the virus from plant to plant, they must acquire it as a larva feeding on an infected plant. So the females have to oviposit on a plant that's already infected. The larvae feed, ingest the virus. The virus, shown here, replicates through the gut and moves back into the salivary glands, at which point it can transmit the virus to a new plant. So knowing the reproductive host range of the thrips and associating that with the virus is a key to understanding some of the epidemiology in the field. And again, because the reproductive host range can be quite large, it means that viriliferous adults can come from a wide range of sources in the field. So controlling the source is at best problematic and more than likely pretty much impossible in open field situations. So what we're really faced with is a problem of thrips dispersal. As Cheryl pointed out, they move from these uncultivated weedy sources or also from senescing crops where they may have picked up the virus and moved into new cropping systems. And the prolificous nature of the adults means that they can transmit the virus to plants that aren't necessarily reproductive hosts. And at least in theory, you can make an argument that non-preferred hosts may be more susceptible to greater disease outbreaks than preferred hosts, because the thrips can come in and it only takes about 5 to 10 to 15 minutes of feeding on a plant in order for the virus to be transmitted. So they can land on a non-preferred host, feed long enough to transmit the virus, and then move to another plant. And then the short inoculation time for the virus also means that insecticides really are not effective in controlling this primary spread of virus from viriliferous adults moving from outside the field into the field. Despite that, of course, growers have historically relied on insecticides to control the Western flower thrips, so much so that we've seen resistance develop to all different or major classes of pesticides. And the And the polyphagous nature of the western flower thrips contributes to its ability to develop insecticide resistance. Because it is polyphagous, and many polyphagous insects have metabolic pathways to detoxify the various plant allelochemicals they may encounter, and these enzyme systems predispose the insect to be able to detoxify the insecticides that we treat it with. Also, because it's a pest on so many different crops, populations are under a constant insecticide pressure. And furthermore, the haplodiploid sex determination means that the haploid males have their alleles under direct selection pressure so that resistance can build up much faster than in diploid organisms. And there's also the potential that's been alluded to in the literature for females that are resistant, surviving long enough to mate with their male progeny, and again, that would facilitate the development of resistance in a population. And it's not just that we've seen insecticides fail to control western flower thrips populations, we often see certain insecticides flaring up those populations. And these are some data from field studies we did in bell peppers, where we treated some plots with a synthetic pyrethroid, S-fenvalerate or Asana, compared to the untreated plot shown here in white. And you can see that we get, well, you could see, you get these spikes in western flower thrips after they've been treated with the pyrethroid, and the populations are higher than in the untreated plots. And so that's partly due to the insects having resistance or tolerance to those materials, but it's also that materials like those pyrethroids kill off the natural enemies like pirate bugs that are very good thrips predators, and they also can eliminate competing thrips species. So it in effect gives the western flower thrips a degree of enemy-free space where their populations can flourish in the absence of these other natural enemies or competitors. And there's some mounting evidence that some of these materials like synthetic pyrethroids can actually enhance or increase the fecundity and reproduction of the western flower thrip. So it's like a double whammy of bad news that you if you overuse certain materials. Okay. So over the last couple of decades or so since the western flower thrips has emerged as a pest, we've learned a great deal about its behavior and its reproductive biology, the host range that it has, and its ability to transmit these different TOSPO viruses. And so while we have learned a great deal, I think there's still some outstanding questions about the ecology that we need to address, including getting a better handle on the reproductive sources of the thrips and which plants it's actually picking up the virus from in the field over time. There's still a lot that we don't know about the dispersal behavior of western flower thrips, how far individuals can travel, what triggers that movement, and what triggers their alighting on new host plants. What factors play into that? And one of the most significant questions to me is one posed originally by William Kirk and Irene Terry in one of their review articles, is that the western flower thrips has become this worldwide invasive pest. Is there something unique about it, or do other similar related species of Franklinella or other related thrips have similar biological attributes that may allow them at some point in time to be likewise invasive species that we'll have to contend with in the future? So with that, thank you.